Some of you have heard parts of this story, but nobody's heard the complete story, and the complete story isn't even here. That's all a disclaimer because my wife wanted me to say that. It's true. Back in 1976, I was finishing my freshman year of college at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, and I was thinking about what I was going to do for the summer when the dean of students approached me and asked if I'd be interested in interviewing for a job on Congressman Dre Litton's United States Senate campaign. I said without hesitation, yeah, absolutely. It sure beats working at a truck stop from midnight to 8 in the morning out on Route 44. And a week later, after school had ended, I went for my interview at the Litton campaign headquarters in Kansas City, Missouri. There were five of us. I was the only freshman. The other four were graduating seniors, all from Westminster College, interviewing for one position, advance man, which means you kind of navigate all of the routes and plan all of the events that the candidate goes to. And I remember the campaign manager, John Ashcroft, at the time trying to talk me out of the position that I was interviewing, saying to me, "Hey, it doesn't pay that much," to which I replied, "It pays more than I've ever made in my life." And for every negative that John threw at me, I threw back a positive as to why I wanted this job. After the interview, he said, "You know, I'll get back to you." And I went back to St. Louis to wait for a week for their answer, which was given in this way. They called me and they said, "We're sorry, because we've given the job that you interviewed for, advance man, to another one of your graduating seniors, but..." And I love this because it's the only time a but has ever been great. "But they were so impressed by my tenacity that they created a job for me. Assistant office manager, which meant I was in charge of keeping the stock room supplied with pencils, paper, paper clips, highlighters, and the like." Well, this wasn't much of a job in terms of a challenge, let's put it that way. I got that job done in a couple of hours every day. And so I had plenty of time on my hands to do other things, so I'd go around the campaign headquarters looking for what else I could get involved in. And I started fundraising for them on the phone, and pretty soon I became their number one fundraiser. And I did that for a month, and pretty soon word went all the way up to the very tippy top that there was this kid, as they referred to me, who was raising all this money for the congressman, and the congressman wanted to meet the kid. So the next thing I know, I'm meeting with the congressman, and the congressman offers me a job as his personal aide. And so for the final 2 months of the campaign, I got to know Jerry Litton very well because I traveled with him everywhere he went. One of the most remarkable things about Litton was his unshakable confidence. I had never met, and nor have I since, a person like this. He was a self-made millionaire. He had come from poverty. He was a talk show host that had a huge following in the Midwest. He was a cattle rancher of the Charlet cattle brand, a breed that is a French cattle, for those who are into cattle, and a man who had his sights set on much higher office than the United States Senate that he was currently running for. They were already printing up Litton for President stickers. That's how confident they were. On August 3rd, 1976, the night of the election, primary, I was a nervous wreck, and I was pacing about Litton's house because I couldn't sit still. And he was just as calm as a cucumber, calm as a cucumber. But I was driving him nuts. So he told me, he said, "Kid, I want you to take the car and I want you to go back to the headquarters in Kansas City." And I did. And he said he'd be back a little later that night with his family, and they'd fly and join us for the election headquarters, at the election headquarters for the celebration. I know that Litton believed he was going to win because he told me that. He told me that over and over. He told me that we were going to win this thing bigger than anybody ever expected. And he said this without any other information than just his gut. I mean, there was no exit polling at the time. At least we couldn't afford it. There was nobody to tell us that this was the case. And so when Litton said to me that we were going to win this bigger than we'd ever thought, I put a smile on my face and I drove back to Kansas City. Well, later that night, the polls closed, and just before he got in the plane, he called the campaign headquarters. And he said, "Kid, tell everybody I'm on my way, and tell everybody to get the celebration started because we're going to win this thing big. That was the last time anybody spoke with Congressman Litton, at least that I'm aware of, because 10 minutes later came a ticking noise across the AP wire machines in our office, saying that a small plane at the Chillicothe Airport just outside of Kansas City had crashed shortly after takeoff. And with that announcement, Congressman Litton, his wife, his son, his daughter, Paul Rupp, his best friend and pilot, and Paul Rupp's son were no more. So when I read about these two disciples walking defeated and dejected, confused and angry towards Emmaus, I know what they're going through. We were there waiting for the ball to just drop. We were ready to catch it, ready to celebrate a victory that was ours that never got to be realized. The man who was going to take them to the very tippy top, Jesus, was like our Litton for us, and he was dead at 33, not much younger than Litton was when he died in that crash. And with his death went all hope of glory, all hope of going beyond where we had been. You see, I've known for too long a time that everybody has to walk the Emmaus Road at some point in their life. It comes to everybody. It's the road of great loss and great disappointment and the never-ending what if he had not died, racking your mind. So here they are, two of them, Theophas and Cleophas, heading home. Nothing else to do. There's nothing else for me to do either. After the funeral, which was weird, just sitting there looking at seven caskets in front of us, it felt like we were in a cloud, like it was a dream. It wasn't even a nightmare. It was just surreal. This just doesn't happen. You don't win a United States Senate election and then die on the way to the victory party. Who does that? Nobody. So here they are. They're heading home. The Messiah, the one who had been promised for thousands of years to Israel, suddenly dead on a tree, a common criminal's death. Heading back, they were to Kansas City, Jerusalem. And out of nowhere, then, the story tells us a stranger appears on this road. He meets them where they are, on the road, right in the middle of all that pain and all that what-ifing, all that frustration, all that despondency, all that despair that threatens to utterly overwhelm them. And I want you to notice what takes place. This stranger begins to open up the scriptures, but not as some intellectual exercise where they're to memorize Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus, for example, but as a story. He opens it up to him as a story. Didn't you know the story of Moses? Didn't you know the story of Elijah? Didn't you know the Messiah had to do this? He tells them. And out of that storytelling on this road, he begins to make sense of what happened by showing them how the scriptural story is their story. And then he sits down with them at a table because they're hungry. And he shares a meal with them. And he takes and he lifts the bread and he blesses and breaks it. And he gives it to them. And in that simple action, that simple gesture, they begin to recognize who it is that serves them. The one whose presence calls light out of darkness and gives life to those who feel dead inside. And then he's gone. Gone. So they get up. And they go back that evening over that same road that they had just traveled. But this time everything is different. Everything has changed because of what they've seen, what they've heard, and what they've just done together. Can you begin to find yourself in this story? Because this is what we do as human beings. We are blessed and we are broken. Not necessarily in that order. We all must make sense of life and find the story that gives our lives meaning and purpose. We all gather and eat a meal at least once a day, sometimes more. And then we all move on to places yet unknown, because that is the nature of what life is. Now, that Emmaus Road can be a long road, or it can be a short road. It was only 7 miles for the disciples. My road was a much longer road time-wise. I didn't cry for 10 years after Litton died. I didn't cry the night he died. I didn't cry at his funeral. It was so surreal and unreal to me that I just couldn't cry. Until the evening of August 3rd, 1986, 10 years to the day, I was sitting in a room at the Pennington Presbyterian Church being examined for my first call to ministry by the Reverend Sue Reisinger. And I'll never forget it. Susan asked me to talk about the hardest thing I had ever gone through in my life up to that point. And without a hesitation, without a thought, I burst into tears. And I cried like a baby. Couldn't stop crying. I mean, I sobbed, head in hands, sobbing. And I realized that it had been 10 years to the day that Litton had died. That's a long road. And later that night, at my very first presbytery meeting, we shared communion, just like we're going to share a little bit later. And I will never forget the words that Susan said to me as she handed me the bread and chalice that night. She said, "Stephen, especially for you, this is my body, which is broken for you. And this, more importantly, Stephen, for you, is the cup of new life." And in that instant, I knew what those two disciples knew as they headed back to Jerusalem to tell the others that they had just experienced the risen Christ. It's not a bad pattern to emulate, is it? Not a bad pattern. First you take and you meet people where they are, whatever road they're walking on. You share the hope of our sacred story so that folks can make sense of their lives in light of God's ultimate promise. And then you gather with others who are on this journey over a meal that is made sacred by our wounds and by Christ's presence in them. And then we send one another on our way back out into the world, just like we will today, to partner with God in this never-ending process of binding up the brokenhearted and sharing the news that death does not get the last word. The resurrection does. Thank God. Amen.